Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears coming at you here on a Getaway Friday, February the 10th, 2023. Now, February or February, however you want to pronounce that, wherever you are. 15 and a half minutes past the hour, and we have got a great show to kick off the morning this morning. We have a lady on who I have wanted to have on for a long time. As many of you know who have been with this program, for about the 9 years we've been on now. No, we have had some great journalists and great people in the broadcasting industry on, from Sam Donaldson to Phil Donahue to Hugh Downs, Eleanor Clift, a lot of great people, too many to remember. This lady is still getting it done each and every day, pretty much, and people enjoy her work, and she falls into both of those categories, journalism and broadcasting, which sometimes can be a little different, and we're going to talk about that with her. What a pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones the host of All Sides with Ann Fisher, weekdays, 10 a.m. to noon, and repeated 8 to 10 p.m. on 89.7 FM NPR News, Ann Fisher. Ann, how are you?
I'm very fine, Scott.
Good to have you on the program. Interesting time. We always say that. Now, is there not an interesting time in the news business at this point?
Yeah, at this point, no. It's very, very busy at this time, yeah.
You know, years ago, we would come in, and there was always new news, but you would say, okay, well, what am I going to talk about today? It seems like in the last 6 or 7 years, it's constant. Why do you think that is?
I think it's kind of a function of sort of our 24/7 news cycle, you know, that we kind of cut our teeth on. At least I did growing up. You know, I think people have kind of been trained to want more. So there's partly the feed the beast, and there's then the externalities of a very divided country. That conflict that brings out, and that brings out a lot of news. Conflict equals news.
What has the 24-hour cable news internet done to the news business?
You mean 24-hour cable and internet?
Both together.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's made it so people can find something to read, some or are looking for something all the time, 24/7. I mean, it's just, and there's the expectation that it'll be there. I mean, I remember when, before the 24/7 news cycle, before, you know, the Iranian Revolution back in, was it 1979, 1980, whatever it was, you know, that's when they started, you know, throughout the night they were following it. And people were tuning in, and, I mean, it changed everything, but it's something that we expect now. It's exhausting.
Well, and how do you, because you take phone calls, anybody who's listened to your program is aware of mm-hmm. that. When somebody calls in and it's a big story, let's say State of the Union, for example, but they've read something on the internet and you know that it is not an accurate story because this happens on the internet, how do we treat that? How do we fix that problem? Or is it fixable?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it's going to be always an issue. I don't think you're going to be able to fix it, but per se, the trend of doing that. We screen our calls, and I see what they're calling in for, and I ask my screeners, if I question that, I ask them to verify before we put them on the air. If they're making an assertion that doesn't, you know, I can't, like, instantaneously know everything everybody's going to say, but if we do know they're going to bring something up, then I'll have those screeners verify what it is. And if they come on the air and they say something that I know is inaccurate or I question, I'll question them on the air and I'll call them out on it. I think we need to call people out immediately, either challenge them, ask them to verify, give a, you know, that kind of a thing. But I try not to give that too much airtime in general. I try to screen beforehand. I don't want to keep person opinions off the air, but I want to keep inaccuracies off the air if I can.
Are you surprised to the degree that normal, average people who work hard and support their families are taken in by some of this news that is not correct?
I'm not surprised because it's been coming on for a long time, and there's, you know, I mean, you just can listen to certain TV, you know, shows, certain cable TV, certain cable news TV. It's just constant. They conflate opinion with the news, and people think it's the news. It's not. It's opinion. There's a something called media literacy, and the idea of media literacy connotes that there's also media illiteracy, right, Scott? And so it's something, being media literate is something you learn. It's not something you're born with. And if we're not taught that, and if someone's not teaching us that, if you don't grow up with, say, the newspaper on the counter like I did in the morning kind of a thing, if you're not watching the news with your parents anymore like I had to do when I was growing up, because that was all there was, you know, you're not learning literacy. And I think that's a big problem. And there's a lot of talk nowadays about bringing media literacy into the curriculum in school so that people can learn to understand what they're reading and how to check sources, how to verify things, red flags if you're looking at a website that is pure opinion but is trying to pass itself off as news. So I'm not really surprised. It's pretty elaborate effort out there to capture people's attention and capture their hearts with inaccuracy.
Now the
people sometimes downright lies.
Yeah.
And lies.
Well, it's interesting because if you look at our business and broadcasting, there are people who get on and do things just like you said. You want people to know what they're talking about. You want them to be right, and you want to point out if something is incorrect. But there are broadcasters themselves who get on every day in Ohio and every other state and nationally, and I don't want to say knowingly say something that's not true, but certainly don't bat it down. And when people hear it on a big station or they hear it from a person they listen to every day, well, then it's the gospel.
Yeah. Yeah. All you can do is just say, how do you know that? Well, I heard it on the news. Well, what did they say that, how did you verify what you heard on the news? Did you get a second opinion? You know, that's all you can do. I don't know how people get up, sleep at night, but I'm a journalist. Those are not journalists. Those are just people who happen to have a microphone. So.
Well, you know, speaking of people who have a microphone, we had an interesting story here in Ohio the last few days. In East Palestine, there was a reporter for News Nation, and Wednesday this happened. Mike DeWine, our governor, was giving a press conference, and this reporter was arrested and put in jail. And the reasons being given at this point, as near as I can tell, going through the information, are that he was being loud, and it might have been interrupting the press conference. Now, the governor has says it shouldn't have happened. I don't know why it happened. I want the media there. I want them to do their job. What have you made of this whole story of the reporter being jailed in East Palestine, Ohio?
I think it's terrible. I can't believe it happened. I can't believe that it happened at all. I mean, I believe that it happened. I've been dragged out of an event myself years and years ago during the Voinovich administration. They were going to sign a bill. I went to the bill signing because I was just killing some time. And it turned out they didn't want the press there. It was supposed to be, you know, they had announced that they were doing it. I showed up anyways, and they finally came up to me and said, if you don't leave, we'll have the state highway patrol come in. And I was too immature, I guess. I didn't understand fully my rights, and I got up and left. I was humiliated. It was a horrible experience, and, you know, I raised hell afterwards once sort of the shock wore off, but it's, I don't know what the governor's going to do about it, but hopefully, you know, change, you know, make sure that the whoever's guarding him, who's ever doing this, gets, that there's consequences and that there's protocols that, you know, established for the future. It's just unacceptable.
The interesting thing about this was the arrest was made by the East Palestine Police Department, but this guy, this reporter for News Nation, he spent some time in that jail, and what's confusing to a lot of people, I think, who are reading this story, because now it's become a national story in the last 24 hours, is Governor DeWine is denying that he wanted this to happen. He's denying that it should have happened, but he also did not try to get this person out of jail. He didn't. There was no movement. You know, it's a strange story.
Yeah, it is a strange story. I'm curious myself of what they're going to do about it. I think he said that they didn't want them to press charges. They will not press charges. They don't want him to face any. But I don't know why. He's out now, right, Scott?
He is out now. Yes.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, we shall see. I mean, it isn't a good look, that's for sure.
The only follow-up I have on this is it possible for a governor who's giving the press conference in the room, looking at the media, because this was quite a scuffle, it looked like, is it possible for him to be totally unaware or no aide to come up to him at some point and say that this happened while this guy spent a number of hours in jail?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the circumstances were. I don't know why he wasn't told sooner, why this wasn't immediately addressed. I don't know. I don't know, Scott.
Yeah. Different story, to be sure. And do want to let everybody know this morning, we are chatting with Ann Fisher, host of All Sides with Ann Fisher, weekdays 10 a.m. to noon on 89.7 NPR News. And, of course, you can get the podcast of Ann's show as well. Ann, want to dive back into your background here. How did you get into journalism?
I was in the third grade, and a substitute teacher told me that she thought I was a good writer. And I said, what do writers do for a living? Because I was very much career-oriented. And she said, well, sometimes they become journalists. And I said, what's a journalist? And she said, it's somebody who works for a newspaper. And I was like, okay, that's what I'll do. And that's what I did. And it's pretty much as simple as that. For the rest of my life, you know, growing up, I was going to be a journalist, and then as I, you know, approached college age, my parents realized I was serious about it and started trying to talk me out of it, and they failed. And I just, you know, went to Michigan State University, went to journalism school there, I don't even know how to say it. I know it's freakish. I met lots of people in college who didn't know what they wanted to do, and that's very typical today as well. People don't know what they wanted to do. I've always known I wanted to do this, and I've been lucky enough to be, you know, live the dream.
Recently, we had the death of Barbara Walters, legendary journalist, and so much was made during her death, the coverage of her death, of how hard it was for her in the 1970s and the 1980s to be a woman in the broadcast industry, and also to have a life where she had a husband, where she had kids, where she had a strong relationship because she was always at work. Do you find those to be accuracies? Because you're of that time as well.
Well, I grew up, you know, she was, you know, in the morning before I go to school, we would have the Today Show on, and she was, you know, very much a role model for me. I mean, you know, it was, I guess I'm not quite sure whether I understand the question, whether or not, you know, that she had a support system that enabled her to do it.
Did you find that hard as well, the things that she faced?
You know, she was on such an elevated level. You know, she was the queen of television news. She made, broke a lot of glass ceilings, had an amazing career. It's a tough business to be in, and she did it with grace and aplomb, and I don't know. I mean, I've always had a lot of support, I mean, except for my parents not wanting me to do it, and they very much did not want to do it, did not want me to be a journalist. They were mortified, as a matter of fact, and embarrassed. So I didn't have a lot of support on that score, but I've always had a very supportive husband. It's just never been a question. I did take a few months off when I had my son. It was a challenge, but I went right back to 10 and 12 hour days because I went back to work during the budget cycle. I was covering state government and politics for the Toledo Blade, and I went right back to work doing 10 and 12 hour days. It was tough. But I'm glad I stuck with it because it gave me sort of the agency, to wind up here. It was a good move for me to stick with it.
You say your parents were embarrassed. That's a big word. Why were they embarrassed?
They thought journalists were kind of seedy, and, my parents were very political, very conservative Republicans, and didn't like the media, and just thought it was a seedy business. And I guess they were unaware that a lot of other people think that politics is seedy. they just didn't want me to be. They thought for a while, what if I went into TV journalism? And I wasn't interested in that. You know, I wanted to be a muckraker. I wanted to be be an ink-stained wretch, and they thought I could have done, quote-unquote, a lot better with my life. But in the end, I mean, I think they were pretty proud of me.
You know, and it's an interesting thing, because when you're covering a certain area, let's say Toledo, you do end up covering the mayor, you do end up covering city council, you do end up covering other people who are in office, firefighters, police officers, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. You have to be somewhat close with them, because you want them to trust you to tell you things if you have a question, but if mm-hmm. you get too close, if a bad story comes along, does it become harder to write that story negatively about this person you see and talk to all the time?
Well, that's the difference. I mean, I think you always have to have a professional distance. You don't make promises to sources that you're not going to keep. So that, I think that's key. I mean, there always should be an understanding that I'm a journalist and you're a source, and usually your best sources aren't the people at the top. They're not the mayor. They're not the police chief. It's somebody else, that's telling you what's going on. So I've never had a problem with getting too close with big shots. It's not something I am interested in. And, I've written tough stories and had tough conversations with people. I guess it's just the difference between, a person who's not a journalist and a person who is, and a professional. You know, you just have to, do it, or you have to walk away. I mean, you're not fit for the job, kind of. So it's just never been one of my issues. I always try to keep a pretty clear line.
If somebody in a town or a city is stealing money, if they're involved in an altercation like Governor DeWine was involved in with this reporter, of course most people are going to say that's news. But things that happen in people's personal life, affairs, just anything of a personal nature that goes back, that did not used to be news. When did that become news, and do you think that's fair game?
It depends. I mean, I think actually it always has been news. If it's somebody famous, there's always been, you know, Page Six, you know? There's always been gossip columns, you know, that kind of a thing. And there's always been an appetite for it and a demand for it. It's not my cup of tea, but it's always been out there. Now, I mean, if it's something personal in their personal life that affects their job, it affects their something about what they do as a public person, then yeah, it's fair game. If you want to be a public person, you got to be aware that your private life could become part of the news eventually.
Newspapers are very interesting today, and for somebody who came from newspapers when they were still pretty much in their heyday, a lot of newspapers online now, certainly things that are delivered locally, not a lot of local news in there, a lot of stuff that's reprinted from national news. What is the biggest problem? When you sit down and read a newspaper today, what do you look at and go, boy, that just wouldn't fly years ago?
Well, I think it's, for me, looking at it from the inside out, it's the editing. Not the local editors, but like, say the Dispatch gets edited somewhere in Texas, you know, the copy editing, the final thing, and they get headlines wrong, they don't understand the story, they don't know what the context of the story is, there's misspellings, you know, there's a lot more typos and things like that. But it's really hard when they get a headline wrong, you know, because that's what gets people into the story. That's the introduction. And when you get that wrong, you just start to, you know, you lose credibility. And I think that moving the copy desk, that final look at the material, at the content, moving that to another state, I guess they have to do it. I don't know what their circumstances are financially and how much money that saves them, but I think it really hurts the product and hurts the credibility. And it's not just the Dispatch. It's happening all over the country.
You know, hearing from the listeners here in this area, and we still get the paper delivered every day but Saturday, one of the interesting complaints that I have heard is there are so few reporters that the reporters there are either so young or from a different area that they don't understand the context of certain people or certain things in the community, and I'm not sure how you get that.
Well, I mean, that is an issue. It's a much younger workforce now because the older reporters were too expensive. They're being paid fairly. They earned every dime they ever made, but that's just the way it is. And then it used to be, you know, when you were a young reporter, you'd come back to the newsroom and you'd have an editor or somebody there to guide you. And I think those people, there are still some really great people at the Dispatch, but there's not that other reporter sitting next to you with 20 years experience. There just isn't that anymore. And I don't know how you address that except to be acutely aware of it. And, you know, hopefully the editors can pick up the slack, but there aren't enough editors either anymore. So, yeah, it's a problem. It's always been a problem with young reporters, but there was always a backdrop of the more experienced, seasoned people to help. And that just doesn't exist anymore.
39 minutes past the hour here at WGH Talk on this Getaway Friday morning. The guest is Ann Fisher, host of All Sides with Ann Fisher, weekdays 10 a.m. to noon on 89.7 FM, NPR News. Ann, you went from newspaper journalism to broadcasting. How did that happen?
Well, I was a Metro columnist for about 3.5 years. That was my last, not exactly my last job, but 13 years ago, they had the first really big layoff of the Dispatch. I think there was like 45 people were laid off. I did not get laid off. I kept a job, but they eliminated the Metro column. And for about 7 years, it was eliminated. And so when they eliminated the Metro column, at that point, I don't think there was an my recollection is there wasn't an opening on the public affairs desk, and they didn't cut my pay or anything. They just said I was going to be covering schools in like New Albany and I don't know where else. And I just wasn't that interested in that. And so I was pretty demoralized to lose the column. I really, really loved the column. I loved doing it. I felt like I was starting to hit the ground running with it after 3.5 years. And the same day that I found out I'd lost the column, I got a call from a friend who told me that Fred Anderle, my predecessor at WOSU, was retiring the very same day. He had announced that. And my friend said, I think you should apply for that job. I think you'd get it. And, you know, me and I guess 170 other people applied for it, and I got it. It was a process. I had to, you know, go through several interviews and so forth. But I think that what I brought to the table was a pretty vast knowledge of the state of Ohio, because I'd been a state editor for the Dispatch, covered about 29 counties. As a state house reporter, I'd flown all over the state with the politicians and covered the whole state. And I had my public affairs chops pretty much solid. And I'd done a lot of feature writing too. I think it was mostly the public affairs piece of it though that, you know, worked in my favor, and the fact that I had been on the radio many times with Fred Anderle. They knew I could think, I could talk extemporaneously, although I'm not sure I'm doing such a great job today. And, you know, I the personality, chops, experience, that kind of thing, I think it all was kind of a package deal for them.
Being a guest and being a host are very different things. Going behind the microphone, and just the mechanics of broadcasting, the timing, the sound, the callers, all those things. How hard was that to get for you?
I would say for the first 6 months I was a zombie. The technological shift from print to broadcast was hard. It was just a lot to learn. It was a different culture. And I was 52 years old. It's not like I was that old, but it was, you know, it was tiring. I was really struggled for the first 6 months, just, you know, switching the format from using an interview to write a story to making the interview the story, the product, was it wasn't that it was hard. It was just, it took time. It wasn't like I couldn't do it. It just took a lot more energy. So now I still get nervous every day when I go on the air, but I know once that we turn everything on, I'm going to be okay. You know, whereas back then I wasn't really sure I would be okay. So it was hard though, Scott. I've never sugarcoated that one. That was a big transition for me, but good. It was a good one. You know, at that age, to make a switch like that is really, you know, what a privilege and just a wonderful experience.
That's very interesting. You're still nervous today when you go on the air. What are you nervous about?
You know, I've always over-prepared. I always worry I'm not going to, you know, I worry that, you know, when you brought up the point earlier, what if somebody calls up and says something that's not true? You know, or it's a lie, or it's you know, not accurate, or whatever. You know, I always worry something like that's going to slip through. That's why I try to prepare as well as I can. You know, sometimes things like that do come out, or there's a slip of the tongue, or something like that. You know, as well as I do with broadcast, it is what it is, and you don't really want to make a mistake, because you can't really do a take back. You can, but you can't. It's still always going to be out there, right? You know, you can run corrections in a newspaper, you know, or on whether it's an online news or not, you can run corrections. But now it's broadcast; it's out there, and you just have to be very careful. I just think it's not an unhealthy nervousness. I think it's a good, healthy little edge.
I think anybody who's been in broadcasting for any amount of time has one of these moments. What is the moment in broadcasting? When was the moment in broadcasting that if you could take it back, you miss? Said a word, missaid a fact, asked a question, had a bad guest. What's the moment that you wish you could just, if I could just erase that tape?
I won't say what the phrase is, but I used a phrase that is antiquated and racist, and it's so arcane that I grew up thinking it was as benign as could be growing up, but I realize now is racist, and I used it just in passing, and as soon as I said it, I realized that I was going to get called on it, and I did, and I was, anything like that, I would always want to take back, because I just am very sensitive to that kind of stuff, and I think listeners are very sensitive to it, and they should be, and that would probably be it, but I don't want to repeat it. There was another guest that was on that said something anti-Semitic, but not, he's Jewish, he was making a joke. You got to be careful with that kind of stuff, as you well know. I mean, it just doesn't come across the same way. And I wish I could take that back. And as soon as he said it, I said, ugh, that's going to come back, and someone out there, and sure enough, someone out there was very offended. That kind of stuff that we're all learning, I think, how to be more aware of what we're saying and where words and phrases come from and what the origins of them are, and to not, pretend like they don't exist, but just certainly not to use them with my kind of microphone. It's not appropriate, and I've never used the phrase since, and I never will.
By and large, most guests are good, but mm-hmm. Is there a type of guest that you have found that is more challenging than others?
Yeah. Okay. There's two types. There's the one type that is so nervous. I realize now it's usually that they're nervous. When I was first, doing the job, I would think, what in the world? Because they would talk so fast. And now I know that's partly on me. I've got to help relax people and show out myself. But there's the author who will come on, and every time I ask them a question, they'll say, well, it's in the book. they want to sell their book, and I get that, but they don't want to talk about what's in their book because they think that no one will buy the book if they talk about it, which is idiotic. But those people come up once in a while, and now I won't say it on the air, but I'll during a break or something, I'll say, you got to stop doing that. You're killing me. And they usually will. They don't realize what they're doing, but that's about it.
Do you find that in the age of technology, in the age of emails, text messages, social media, and all of that, that younger people who come on, not all of them, but younger people who come on, tend not to realize it's a talk show and there's time to fill?
I think that's younger. I don't define younger. What do you mean? Like
somebody who's never lived in a world without text messaging or internet.
No, I think that, if I have somebody on, they have something to say. And that's usually not much of an issue. And, that's a little bit of my interviewing skill, and I have to be prepared for that. But usually, if they're on, they're on for a reason, something that they care about, something they want to talk about, and they can usually make it work.
What is the booking process for your show? Who do you want on? Who do you not want on?
I want the best person on. That's why we have, experts from across the country on. So a lot of times they're right in our own backyard, and that's fine too. First, we have to decide what the show's about. That's a big thing. So, we have a news peg. Something happened. But what's the show going to be about? How are we going to develop it? What do we want to talk about? What are the questions we want answered? Sometimes you can get all of that with just one person. Sometimes you need to book two or three. It just sort of depends. That's kind of how it starts, is asking yourself, what's the show going to be about? Not what the peg was, but how do we want to develop this and not embellish, that's the wrong word, but what do we want to bring out in this conversation? And then you just find the best experts that you can, and then it's like putting a puzzle together at that point.
How are topics chosen for the show?
I like to say they're ripped from the headlines usually. obviously I do my birding shows, my gardening shows, cooking shows. Those kind of things are not necessarily ripped from the headlines, but usually it's something, it's the news. And that's what I tell everybody who works for me, all the interns. The first thing is like, learn how to read a paper, learn to explain what are people talking about, and then, you know, that's the beginning. That's how they're chosen.
50 minutes after the hour, 10 minutes left this morning with our guest, Ann Fisher, host of All Sides with Ann Fisher, weekdays 10 a.m. to noon on 89.7 NPR News. Ann, the story we talked about earlier, the reporter being arrested here in Ohio, obviously it's an Ohio story. It's now a national story. Is that something you will do on your show?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure what the I guess it could be a peg for a larger conversation about the, you know, how media works and the role of media. You know, I've been in plenty of, you know, in groups. Particularly when I was a State House reporter, you'd be in a group of reporters. You're pushed to the back of the room, you know, in hostile territory, which I've been in before, where the audience doesn't like the media. They can be very rude and mean. You know, you could talk about that kind of relationship and the role of media, I suppose. But again, it wouldn't just be about that. That's an event. It happened. It's kind of static. It's, you know, over with. You could, you know, I might have somebody on for the first segment to just talk about the event itself and what happened to that reporter in East Palestine. But after that, it would probably be a show about the larger role of journalists at those kinds of events.
What do you hope, after listening to your program, that most of the audience takes away from it?
I hope that they learn something new. That's about it, that they learn something new about things that are important to them, whether it's their voting rights or their health, law enforcement, whatever. During the the height of the pandemic, we did a show a week just on COVID-19. That summer of 2020. There was so much disruption to the voting process, we did, I don't know how many shows on how to figure out how to vote that fall, because things were so up, you know, topsy-turvy, and the rules were changing so fast. So, so I want to inform them, I take away something that they didn't know before, and help them, you know, carry out their day.
If you could put a show in a time capsule, what would it be?
Oh, my gosh. I don't even know. I mean, you mean which would be my... Are you asking
your
my
favorite,
favorite
yeah.
Show?
Yeah, 50 years from now, somebody pulls that time... Or 100 people pull that time capsule out. This is the Ann Fisher Show. What would that be?
I think it would probably be one of my reporter roundtables. I think that's the most popular show of the week. That's the first thing people say when they say, I love your show. Oh, and I really love the reporter roundtable on Mondays. I think one of those would be it, because it's kind of my wheelhouse. It's where I feel most comfortable. And I think it's the most important thing we do all week, is tell people what's going on with state government, which is so, so important to everybody's lives. So, yeah.
How do you pick the guests who are going to be on your show?
It just depends. Like I said, if it's what they're talking about, if they're an expert, if there's a book out, Judy Collins wrote a memoir several years ago. I got Judy Collins on the show, and she actually, for an hour, and she started to sing on the air. If I can get a Judy Collins, I'll get a Judy Collins. I've interviewed lots and lots and lots of famous people now, it just depends on if they're the best that I can get. That's what I shoot for. You want people who can express themselves on the radio and that kind of a thing. If you get the right people who know what they're talking about, and you're usually going to do all right.
A lot of radio, a lot of broadcasting now is opinion-based, as we talked about earlier, and if you tune into a lot of those shows, even if the host has a guest, you hear more of the host's voice than you hear of the guest's voice. On your show, percentage-wise, how much should they be hearing your voice versus the guest?
They should be hearing my voice maybe 10% of the time.
Does it always work out that way?
You know, I think with the reporter roundtable, for instance, I may chatter more because I can. I mean, I know the material sometimes, but I think it usually does. I mean, I might, like, say if I have Deb Kanapke on to talk about gardening, we'll, you know, do a little bit more back and forth than I would if I were interviewing an expert on COVID-19. I mean, what am I? I can't chatter too much about it. I just ask questions and hopefully get into a conversational thing with somebody, but they're doing most of the talking. But I think as little as possible do people want to hear from me.
Do want to let you know, Ann, that and our listening audience, that we're getting messages here this morning from Mary Kay out there listening. Great interview. Jeff and I listen to all sides every day, and shows are awesome.
Oh, that's sweet. Thank you, Mary Kay.
Absolutely. And any regrets?
Oh, my goodness, no. I mean, no, not a bit. I just feel so lucky to have sort of lived out this dream. And it's true. I decided when I was in the third grade I wanted to be a journalist, but it wasn't like there weren't bumps in the road. There certainly were. And I'm glad I just stuck with it. I feel so privileged. And so I just feel very lucky. And I appreciate all the Mary Kays out there who are listening and supporting public radio, supporting journalism. You know, it's just been a wonderful ride.
How long do you want to keep on keeping on?
As long as I can, you know. It's a young person's business, I think, in a way. But, we'll see.
go as long as, you know, you can have the microphone. You talked about interviewing famous people. Who is the person you had on the line or in the studio, and you thought, I can't believe I'm talking to this person?
Oh, there's been a few. Jane Pauley, I had her in the studio. Jimmy Carter, I hit him on just a few weeks before he was diagnosed with that brain cancer. He was incredible. Jane Pauley was wonderful. Judy Collins. I mean, Ed Woodward and Bernstein, I had them on. There's been so many now I can't even keep track of them anymore. You know how that is. But a lot of times my favorite interviews are just with ordinary people who share something extraordinary. So fame is good, but a great interview doesn't necessarily require a famous person.
2 minutes left to go. What was your best interview?
Oh, my best interview. I don't know. I mean, I honestly don't know. I guess it depends on what mood you're in. Yeah, what mood I'm in. I do remember soon after I started interviewing Julie Zicafus, the naturalist, and I remember that was when we would repeat the shows over the weekend. And one day I was driving around and I was listening to the radio and I heard this interview and I'm like, well, this is really interesting. And I still wasn't used to hearing my voice. I didn't realize it was me. That sounds ridiculous, but I don't know. I couldn't even begin to Scott. I couldn't even begin to narrow it down. It's just 13 and a half years. It's been too many great experiences.
How would you like to be remembered by people?
As being reliable, authentic, and covering the issues that people care about.
Not a bad epitaph for a reporter at all. The guest this morning has been Ann Fisher, host of All Sides with Ann Fisher, weekdays 10 a.m. to noon on 89.7 FM NPR News. Ann, we've wanted to have you on for so long. It's so great to have you on, and I hope you can come back with us in the future.
Thanks, Scott. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Ann Fisher, I'm sure you know the name in the Ohio area. Hey, we're going to be back in 15 minutes. Don't you dare tune away.
Coverage from the Republican National Convention with conservative icon Phyllis Schlafly.
This is Scott Spears at the 2016 Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio at the Quicken Loans Arena, and we are joined by a conservative icon, Mrs. Phyllis Schlafly. Phyllis, how many conventions have you been to?
Well, I came to my first one in 1952.